So one can well argue that the figures of Saint Paul, Count Roger, and Lavalette came to feature as protagonists in the legitimacy doctrine of 17th century Malta. As far as their historical relationship is concerned, the apostle's name is associated with the Christianization of the island. Count Roger is credited with the expulsion of the Muslim infidels and the return of Christian rule, while Lavalette is related to the crucial defense of this Christian territory from the Muslim Turks. In short, all three personages represent the virtues of one's ancestors, interpreted from the perspective of a Catholic counter-reformation social background. The figure of Saint Paul is a symbol from below, that is, it represents basic popular expression. On the other hand, Count Roger and later Lavalette came to represent ethnic pride and national revival, respectively. The first originated from the Maltese commune's own sense of distinct identity, the latter from the state, or rather, the government of the order itself. Finally, while geography may set limits to certain ways of life and encourages a particular mode of production and patterns of settlement, here I'm referring to Malta as an island, its position in the geographical position in the Mediterranean, the fact that the surface area, the geographical area is very limited, and so on. A national identity and character and are more directly influenced by collective perceptions encoded in the myths and symbols of the community. Each generation inherits the myths and symbols of previous generations, whose values lies in their ability to create bonds and generate a society in the past through the mythical and emotional union of kin groups sharing a common history and destiny. It has often been argued that for nations to endure, they must not only be founded upon ethnic cores, but they must also include a living past based on myths, symbols, and values. This explains why successive generations of intellectuals in Malta, as elsewhere, are often drawn back to reconstructions of the past, which does not cease to exert a strong fascination and provides an antidote to their avid professionalism. The images they recreate become the unconscious assumptions of later generations. Many modern Maltese carry around with them a taken-for-granted background to their sense of collective identity, which such assumptions as that about the uninterrupted practice of Christianity in Malta since the times of St. Paul's shipwreck, and their fervid attachment to the faith. Even more important are the actual myths attached to those heroes who, at one point in time, helped to shape the nation, locate its borders, and chart its destiny. It is myths, therefore, that help to describe an historical identity, which, together with the accompanying symbols, provide obsolete compensations for much-feared social changes. The British historian Eric Hobsbawm makes a concrete observation in this sense when he argues that communitarian myths are perpetuated and traditions invented, ensuring that the portrayers become at the same time the portrayed. Hobsbawm's argument gains strength if one considers that history must preserve the collective tale of a people, while myths and memories need to be constantly renewed and continually retold in order to ensure the survival of the community. The ethnic group, therefore, emerges from the constant renewal and retelling of a set of values that are often passed from one generation to the next in the form of tales and myths. In the case of Malta, the common cultural values shared by the Maltese proved both potent and vital. Their cultural impact was so strong that they were determinant in forging a Maltese cultural identity, and in turn made it easier for the Maltese to communicate among themselves. These values represented largely by the omnipresent Catholic reality, had by the 16th century become synonymous with being ethnically Maltese. One may argue that in Malta, religion succeeded in creating a cultural homogeneity which was shared as a way of life, as well as a belief system, by all Maltese during a phase in Maltese history when the ethnically Catholic Maltese, notably those living in the harbour towns, had to share their socio-economic and cultural values with a large foreign and mixed community. This is something which is being repeated today in a way. You had free people and slaves, Muslims and Jews, and mostly, practically mostly all of them slaves, Orthodox and also Protestant. In other words, the Maltese Catholic reality marked off the Maltese from outsiders. These outsiders lacked empathy with Malta's national symbols and myths, and for them, Maltese ethnic values that were predominantly seeped in the island's Catholic heritage conveyed no such meaning. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a fascinating paper. About Maltese identity. Being Maltese, I identified with with all the points you raised, actually, and it was interesting to see what my makeup is composed of. It obviously reminded me of the paper you yourself quote, which is The Invention of Tradition by Eric Hobsbawm, and I think it's... I think, apart from everything else, your apartheids were very interesting, such as the fact that I discovered things like Abel and Las Caris were both admirers of the Jesuits, which, for me, I'm going to capitalize on that bit of information for my own research.
They actually both studied with the Jesuits.
Really?
Yes. One here and one elsewhere.
Right, and it's interesting to see all the myths exactly which Maltese still identify with today. That is, for example, the coming of Count Roger to Malta, St. Paul's, the Great Siege, which are sort of three real important points of reference for Maltese and Maltese identity being deconstructed in this way. So I think I thank you very much for that very interesting paper. I'd like to now leave the floor for questions and then perhaps come to my own comments.
I agree with Vicky Carmel, very, very interesting. What I find intriguing is the fact that the figures of Maltese ethnic consciousness, as you put it, namely St. Paul, Count Roger and La Valette, are all foreigners. And this is, of course, I mean, very different from
Indian, very interesting, yeah.
From Indian nationalism, for example, where figures like, I don't know, Shivaji and Gandhi and Ram as the mythical god man are essentially Indian, and that's the whole point of there being figures of Indian ethnic consciousness. Whereas in Malta, the three figures are all foreigners. And not just that, for example, La Valette, the hero of the siege, the foreign hero of the siege, is much more important than Tony Bayada, the Maltese hero of the siege.
I think
this is quite unique, actually, and I would like you to comment on this, if possible.
Yes, a very interesting point. Yes, it's true. If you consider, though, the way the Maltese look at St. Paul, they make him very much their own. During the ritual celebration of Mass, for example, St. Paul is daily referred to Our Father, San Paul Misirna, all the time. So we are... I think it has to do also with the time that all these mythic traditions actually were pushed forward. In the paper I mentioned that these myths were particularly pushed forward in a propaganda campaign which took place in the particularly in the 16th century. We're not saying that devotion towards St. Paul was not there before the coming of the Knights, but it was particularly pushed forward in the 16th century by the Knights. Now, as far as Count Roger de Norman, most of the propaganda for Count Roger was, in my view, I can't say really 100, but in my view, from what from my own research, it was very much pushed forward by Maltese, Abela, Gianfrancesco Abela, who was the Vice Chancellor of the Order. But it is curious, it's true. I mean, I don't think I have an answer for that, really.
I was wondering, Carmen, if it has to do with the sort of selective appropriation of foreigners, which is something which would make Maltese ethnic consciousness quite unique, I suppose, rather than the rejection of foreigners as the other, sort of. We have the selective appropriation of some foreigners, namely St. Paul, Roger, and Lavalette, which have all been granted as Maltese citizenship, in a sense, like the Knights, the rest of. But it would be quite an interesting mechanism, which is, I think, not very present in the literature, this kind of selective appropriation of the other, making it your own, rather than the other being the other by virtue of him or her being foreign. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, couldn't it also be the fact that, I raise a question to this, couldn't it also be the fact that perhaps Maltese, like feats, if we think of Tony Bayada, for example, weren't given the importance perhaps they deserved at the time, and it's only now that we are beginning to discover our Maltese key figures, and mainly in scholars rather than in sort of heroic figures. For example, it's interesting that we never celebrate any heroic figure of the Second World War. Up to now, we don't have one. And, when you go to a country like England, which is rife with the celebration of particular, brave figures, and we know that there were brave men in Malta too, and they were fighting for their lives as well as the lives of their compatriots. Same thing for, I think the figures we tend to identify with are sort of scholars, such as Jules de Soldanis and we're beginning to discover them really now. When you think Ajus de Soldanis' book was published for...
In 1750,
but for public diffusion only a few years ago. It's a quite interesting point. Paul, I think... Yes, sorry.
I did want to add something, though. You cannot simply look at this issue from a social theoretical perspective, because if you do that, then you miss the point. This is it is very much immersed in historical jargon, in historical theory to some extent. Now, in order to appreciate this, for example, the role of Count Roger, the Norman, or whoever it was, because we know that eventually most of the activities which are associated with Count Roger in reality weren't carried out in the time of Count Roger, but in the time of his grandson, whose name was also Roger, but he was a king though. However, and even Lavalette. However, you'd notice that in the 16th and in the 17th century, there is a movement in Europe. There is the emergence, the rise of absolute rulers. Absolute rule now. You can't say that the Grand Master had absolute rule in Malta. It wasn't possible because he depended on the Pope as his ultimate head. However, there are tendencies towards the creation of a particular setup where the leader plays a fundamental role. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is, it is natural in such a society as it was formed, as it was the structure of society at that time, to give importance to the leader, to the man who is running the country, who is in charge. I mean, and this is not something which is carried out only here in Malta. If you look at the role played, for example, by Louis XIV, the Sun King, I think that is a very interesting case in point. This is also the time when the King of Britain, who wanted to rule as an absolute king, is beheaded by Parliament in 1649. So it is important to understand that this is the time when the king plays a fundamental role, the king, the ruler, however it is, plays a fundamental role in society. And since it is emerging at that particular time, that is in the 16th and 17th century, it is only natural that the ruler is given a push forward while the others play a secondary, tertiary, and other less important roles. An interesting point in this, which maybe we may mention is the role played by a very important hero, not just during the siege, but also during the Battle of Lepanto, and a champion of the order. Just to give you an idea, when the Christian fleet celebrated the festivities for the victory at Lepanto, the man in question, I'm referring to Romegas, Marturino Lescaut, known as Romegas. Recently, Carmelo Testa published a book about him. He actually was the standard bearer for the admiral of the papal fleet by the name of Colonna, actually. I can't recall, they were Pompeo, Colonna, there was the other one. The Colonna family, as we know, is a very important family, and there is a very important square in Rome, in the center of Rome, the hub of Rome, where there is Montecitorio. Yeah, I mean, it's a very important, but he actually led a coup against Grandmaster Lacassière, and when he went to defend his position in front of the Pope, Pope Gregory the 13th, he was reprimanded, and eventually he was also humiliated. While when Lacassière went to Rome, he was given all a very warm reception with all the honors, etc. And that gives you an idea of how people looked at power at this time. I mean, we cannot really, I mean, it is very difficult when you are studying history. It is very, the most difficult thing for me is not to study the documents, but to try and put your mind, to try to create the framework as it was at a particular point in time which you study. It's very difficult because we have passed through so many different experiences. The past, after all, is so foreign to us that it is the most difficult thing of all to try to recreate the past, to recreate a proper understanding of the past.
Go on.
I think Charles's reply to Mark explains the reason for, to a certain extent, explains the reason for the foreignness of the heroes in the national myth, in terms of the political structure of the time, which was polar, which was authoritarian, and therefore it did not seem so unnatural to them that the folk heroes would be foreign. But I'd just like to make a small point, and that is that foreign heroes are not necessarily problematic in national myths. After all, there are, I think, quite a few cases, if you look across the world,
Lafayette,
of founders of a society being by definition foreign. I believe ancient Rome had a myth where its founder was foreign, from Greece or Troy.
Yes.
And if we look at Britain, excuse me, if we look at English national identity, they can fit within their sense of national identity foreign founders like William the Conqueror. And of course, if you look at immigrant societies like the United States, the founding fathers were very often necessarily foreign. So I'm not sure the foreignness of the national hero is necessarily problematic.
If I may make another comment, although it's true that these three myths are familiar to all Maltese, but the persons themselves that you mention are very little known. If you ask the man in the street about Count Roger, for example, most people would know next to nothing.
Yes,
even about La Valette, very few would know that he is French, maybe, and that's as far as we go. We know a little more about St. Paul because of the church, but even then, very few people know about the epistles and the teachings and so on. So although these three persons really existed in the collective memory, they're not real persons, rather, but rather, we might say, personifications of concepts. And they have in common that they are all three Christians, and the second two, Contra General Lavalette, both fought against the Turks and the Muslims.
Yes.
And I think this is, for us, this is enough, because in our desire, sort of, is to create a distinction between us and Arabs. Mm-hmm. Not the distinction between us and Europeans is not so important for us. In fact, we try sometimes to play it down. No? So although these are foreigners apart from St. Paul, yes. But the other two are Europeans, yes. And they fought against Arabs and against Muslims. So they are useful for our own, for what we want to portray.
Yes. Incidentally, this issue, though the Maltese know about this, cropped up, particularly in the 70s, when we were getting cheap Libyan oil in Malta in the 1970s, and the Prime Minister then decided, I mean, made a statement, a very strong statement, in which he said that the ancestors of the Libyans and the Maltese are, yes, he mentioned the word blood brothers. There was an outcry in Malta about that, we all remember that. And more recently, just before the referendum, this obsession of joining the European Union, because, you know, we are European. So I think that has also to do with the fact, with the part played on the fringes of Europe. We are peripheral, like the Sicilians to some extent, like the Cypriots, like the people of Crete, although those are part of Greece, Crete, so they don't. But I mean, probably you find the same situation, I don't know, in other places like Sardinia or the Balearic Islands, or maybe the south of Spain, where people feel the need to assert their Catholic identity, their Christian identity, not for the sake of Christianity. I mean, what I find amazing is that you come across quite a few people who hardly ever bother to go to church, who hardly ever bother to practice their religion, but they want to be associated with a Christian culture, because a Christian culture equals European culture. I think we shouldn't overlook this very interesting theme.
Hi, Carmen. What surprises me is the fact that you do not mention at all the British colonial experience, and you seem to attribute to the Hospitaller period a process which I am inclined to believe is more likely to have happened within the framework of British colonialism in the Maltese Islands.
Yes.
And if I may also add a question, what, in your personal opinion, makes these so-called myths or beliefs national as early as the 16th century? No. Because you refer to the formation of a national ideology under Hospitaller rule. Are you referring to the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century? Mm-hmm. Which century are you referring to?
Yes.
And what's so mythical about the Norman conquest?
No, there's nothing mythical about the Norman conquest.
Roger is as historical as...
Yes, no, it's not the myth, there's nothing mythical about the Norman conquest. The mythical point about the Norman conquest is not, it's not the fact itself. In fact, I mentioned how it has been reworked by certain people like Abela. Definitely.
And who after Abela rethinks?
No, but Abela dominates the scene for a very long time.
Up to the 19th century.
Up to the 19th century. Now,
that is precisely my point.
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, for example, the colors of the flag attributed to Roger, in fact, were given by La Ferla in the 1840s.
Yes. So
that was the first time. Yes, yes, you're right.
So Carmel, is it national identity or just Abela's own?
No.
Idiosyncratic.
Probably.
Opinions which were imposed, lock, stock and barrel, on a local Maltese cultural elite. And
yes, no. I think yes.
A distinction should be drawn between national and elitist.
National identity, as such, I think one can only. I like.
I know it's tricky, but.
No, I have discussed this. I have discussed this. And you know, I mean, I'm sure you know that I have discussed the idea of national identity here. Unfortunately, I had to summarize a lot. You know that I have discussed the 19th century, the British period, and I make a difference between ethnicity and national identity. I tend to be supportive of Gellner's view. Propounded in Nations and Nationalism way back in 1983, when he says that to speak of nationalism, you have to speak of the post-French revolutionary phase. I think I agree with that. I think he's right. So here we are speaking mostly of ethnic identity more than anything else. The idea of nation, I tend to concur that the idea of nation emerges very clearly in Malta, I would say, during the time of Vassalli. In other words, we know that Vassalli was influenced by people like the Abbé de Grégoire, who was, although he was a priest, he was very much a follower of the French Revolution. He wanted to reform the education system in France. We know that de Grégoire was very much also influenced by the ideas of Herder, who propounded the need for a national language, so the idea of language, the idea of citizenship, the idea of nation. That is definitely end of the 18th century. What I try to do here is to look at the basics of it. It is only later that the idea of national identity, I would agree with that, that the idea of national identity is forged. Incidentally, going back to St. Paul, we know that the importance associated to St. Paul's shipwreck as a shipwreck and the feast of St. Paul's shipwreck as the feast of, rather than the feast of the conversion of St. Paul at the parish in Valletta, that is, I'm not sure whether it is very late 18th or very early 19th, but we are there. So I would tend to concur with your view. Yes, definitely. There's no discussion on that.
Did the religious congregations brought over by the Knights have an influence on the Maltese Church?
Well, most of the congregations were here much earlier than the Knights. Most of them were here in the 14th. Am I right? I will have a medievalist here who can actually confirm. Is it the 14th? From very early 15th century, even earlier. Even the 14th, some of them the Franciscans, I think.
Undocumented.
Yeah, well, undocumented, what is a big argument on that, yes, I know. So the only order which established itself during the time of the Knights are the Jesuits, yes. Well, and then you have the nuns as well, several congregations of nuns. And when we speak of nuns at this stage, we are speaking of cloistered nuns. In particular.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed your talk very, very much. And I will follow up, if you like, the first question you had about the perhaps interesting idea that the heroes of Maltese identity might be foreigners. And the second part of that I think is related to it, if you like, is that all of them are so closely related to, if you like, the establishment. You used the term in your talk at several points, these construction of these as being, quote, propaganda.
It is.
Which I think we could easily see, and we can easily see also that these kinds of ideas would have served very, very effectively for consolidating the kind of state and church arrangement that those who were in control of Malta wanted to have. And so it's not surprising that a lot of the sources upon which this would be drawn would be from those very same sets of interests. The issue, I think, is how is it that the Maltese ethnic identity becomes identified with this? And with what level of anxiety or difficulty? I bear in mind your other point, which you didn't follow up on, which was the Semitic language and the Semitic part of the identity and your reference to. In my view, that's a very deep, even now in contemporary Malta, a very deep and disturbing issue. And this has to form part of the explanation for the quick adoption of this characterization of the Maltese people as they then were and as they are and as their destiny is. But I think it's somewhat more convincing at that time as a set of ideas that served an establishment that was developing themselves in an extremely fragile and threatening international environment in terms of the Muslim threat in the Mediterranean at these times, and perhaps less convincingly in terms of it being, I mean, what reasons do we have for thinking that at that early stage that the Maltese people themselves bought into this and bought in themselves as this is their story and this is their identity? It's easier to see how that might evolve later, but I just leave it with you. But I think I think that set of tensions are extremely important. I think also this issue of the Semitic thing, it would have been deeply in Maltese interest to buy into this in order to settle exactly that question, that they would not be, even in themselves, seeing themselves in an Arabic context or perspective, and that they had a vital interest in that. Is there anything at all in the literature you've gone through to speak to these
things? Yes, well, actually, this is a time when the Maltese islands were continuously, especially in the 16th century, being attacked. Farmsteads were being looted from everything, and people taken away into slavery. And we have an occasion in 1551 where practically all the population of Gozo was taken away into slavery. This is not a myth. Now, this is not something spectacularly Maltese only. We have to remember that this is something which we share with other people. I have just returned from a conference in the Liguria, which is, it's not far from Nice, and there is a town where the island, where the people there are called Iturki, the Turks. The reason for this is that in 1637, this particular town was attacked by the Algerian pirates. For them, they are Turks. And this is important, they don't make a distinction between Turks, proper Turks, and North African, Maghreb Muslims. And they took practically all the population away into slavery. Now, the interesting thing about this case is that eventually they were, the foundation for the redemption of slaves, they were eventually redeemed, most of them. Now, they took away a lot of women and children. But obviously, between the period of enslavement and the period of coming back, there is a lapse of time. And therefore, during that period, a lot of women actually got pregnant. And therefore, the net result was that you found that the people of the surrounding towns, villages, what have you, started to call these people Iturki, the Turks, because they are the sons of the Turks, or the children of the Turks. And they're still being called the Turki, still to this day. This is in the province of Savona. It's very interesting. It's next to the old town of Albenga, to the Byzantine town of Albenga. So it's a very interesting place. It is a fact, for example, Butera, at the time when the Gozo population was taken away into slavery, Butera was ransacked 6 times. The whatever was left of Butera, I mean, the people of Butera, this is in Sicily, on the south coast of Sicily, were taken away. If you consider, pardon me, Favignana, that's it, Favignana again, Sardinia, even Provence was attacked, even Cadiz in Spain. So these people were all the time. So we had what I'm trying to say is that as far as Christianity is concerned, we shared a common culture with these frontiers of Christianity. We were frontier societies, all of us. Sicily, the south of Italy. On one occasion, this is a document which I found recently in Rome, in 1588, you have a community in the not far from Ostia. It's not far from Rome, from Ostia itself, which is taken away to slavery. And in this document, which is in Rome, there is a whole list of people who were taken away into slavery. One of the few people who managed to survive was the parish priest, who was lucky. But many others, and he gave the whole list of people missing from his village. Incidentally, the village was on a hill, so these people really ventured. I mean, the fact that they went inside, they landed on a beach, and they had to walk for a couple of miles before they arrived at this village. They took away these people. In other words, they had to walk again down to their vessels, and then they took them back to their to North African coast.
Fight and walk back to the. I don't think they could.
Well, no, they were actually tied and taken back. I mean, and here again, a lot of women and children are involved.
Right. Mark, you wanted to.
First of all, to comment on what David Milne said, I think he's right. The interesting question is, how is it that the church and state, mythmongers, as it were, managed to convince the rest of the population that our figures are indeed Saint Paul, Roger, and well, I think it's sort of widely documented in the anthropological literature that cultural entrepreneurs, as Frederick Barth calls them, quite often manage to let's say dictate, maybe too strong a word, but to pattern at least the thought of ethnic groups and to give a form to what ethnic groups believe their main myths and whatever are. So I think it's quite a common situation to find entrepreneurs, in this case church and state, and I fully agree with David Milne, and I think it's a good point. Second, with respect to what Charles Dudley said on this, the big question on is it an ethnic group or is it a nation? Of course, there's an endless debate going on in history and anthropology on ethnic groups and primordialism, modernism, etc. And I think the view you take, Carmel, in this talk, as well as in your book, which I've read several times actually, I think it's very similar to Smith's position.
Yes,
which is the idea that, of course, nationalism as a particular political project originated in the late 18th century with German thinkers, Fichte, Herder, Immanuel Kant as well, and all the rest.
Yes.
But that nationalism was grafted onto a much older formation, which is what Smith calls ethne. Yes. So I think your position is very, very similar to A.D. Smith's. Of course, then you give it a local flavor, and your research is of course different from Smith's. But I think in theoretical terms, your position is very close to Smith's.
Well, because Smith tries to kind of reach a consensus between the various debates, you know, the various schools of thought. However, I like to use ethnic identity before the 18th century, I mean, at least up to the 18th century. I prefer to use the term ethnic rather than the term nation. I think calling it national up to that time, it's a little bit, you're overdoing it, in my view. But that is an opinion. I mean, these are opinions and which needs to be studied properly, I would say, because we're all the time messing things up. Normally, we don't make these refined distinctions when we are talking on in official matters.
Little aparte for any historian or anthropologist here. I think it's April, the London School of Economics will be celebrating the retirement of Anthony Smith.
Really?
There's a two-day conference on nationalism, so
my
we
goodness.
Might be interested
because
in that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I will be interested, actually.
Paul?
Well, an interesting sort of triangular debate is going on here with Charles. And I'm going to reply to David analogously to the way I replied to Mark. That is to say, again, I don't find it problematic that local people or lower classes should buy into a national myth which, as Charles argued, is invented by the state or the political elite, a la Hobsbawm, a la Gellner. I don't find that problematic, because it seems to me that underlying the theory which Charles is using, Smith and others, which he is using to bring together his factual material, is an old structural functionalist theoretical idea, which is simply that if the whole in question is a political whole, a state whole, or even an ethnic whole, it's almost by definition, linguistically, essential that the heroes of that whole be defenders of that whole, from which it follows that the logic of a national myth is one which is going to prefer heroes of power, heroes of establishment, through the generation. So again, my feeling about David's comment is similar to my feeling about Mark's comment, that I find nothing strange about either the foreignness of an ethnese folk hero or the establishment or elitist nature of an ethnese folk hero.
I think the point of power perhaps is something you could comment on, actually, because this notion of having a hero who is powerful, and perhaps can we therefore question the power levels of the Maltese, and therefore perhaps not being
if
able
I may
to
just
identify.
Jump in Vicky and add out a little point here. I think the left always finds it difficult to come up with the national folk hero precisely because the left is so oriented in people who tend to be out of power that we may see that Mintoff may finally reach that status in the Maltese case, but it's rather unusual.
Well, he certainly achieved a status of importance, that's doubtless. But I was also thinking of the creation of, I'm trying to remember desperately the famous hero who was totally created in I think Irish literature, wasn't it? What's his name? And who basically was this great mythical figure, but created de toutes pièces, as they would say in French. Yes, that's it, yes. Okay, you want to comment about that at all?
No, obviously, there was a reference to, for example, the British period, the 19th century. There was a reference to the language, to the uses of language. Well, here, I am very much restricted to I restricted myself to one hour talk, but originally, you may not have been here at the time. Originally, most of these arguments were discussed in this book, and they are there all together, where I discuss the rise of the state, where I discuss so many other issues. Because I think it would be wrong to look at identity as something particularly religious or political. There is much more to it. I mean, in order to have the creation of an ethnic identity, you also have the emergence of particular classes in society, for example. And also, one needs to understand also that Malta at this time was very much participating in the standard practices, we may say, of Europe at the time. For example, you have the emergence of a business class. It's very important. So we had the emergence of a business class just as much as any other little state and any other larger state of Europe or power of Europe, like, I don't know, France or other places, participated actively in this. So the Knights really transformed Malta. From a backwater of the Kingdom of Sicily, Malta of the Knights became a state, in a way, in its own right. De facto, de facto, it became a state in its own right. De jure, it remained officially attached to Sicily. However, in reality, with the presence of the Knights, particularly even more so in the later part of the 17th century, I would say during the time of the Grand Master Scott Honor, between 1660-1680, during that time and onwards, we have the establishment of a particular society where people express themselves in a certain way. They have their own town, they have their own city, they have their own commercial elite, they have their own nobility. Most of them are being entitled by the Knights themselves, especially in the early 18th century. You have a certain a society which functions with entrepreneurs, people, investment going on. You have investment of all sorts, for example, the Monte di Pietà, but you also have the foundation of the Monte for the redemption of slaves. So you also have tribunals which specify how commerce should be organized. There are a lot of things which are functioning at this time. And I think that the 17th century, in my view, is a great time for the development of this particular society, which nowadays we take for granted. And many people say, well, most of these things took place in the 19th century, well, or in the late 18th. Most of them, most of the base of the base had already been prepared in the 17th. In other words, in the period immediately after the siege, let's say by the immediately after the plague of 1592-93. In other words, from the early 17th century. So, in my view, the period in question, which I try to look at in some detail, is fundamental for our understanding of this society in which we live.
Right. Well, I'd like to thank you very, very much for such an interesting paper, and I'd like to thank you all for this very interesting discussion. Right. So, next works in progress is by Father Pierre. We have a symposium with Father Pierre Greg Margaret, Mrs. Marcia Grima, and Dr. Leo Bencini, and we shall be speaking about refugees, illegals, and immigrants in Malta.
You have listened to Work in Progress, a series of seminars on understanding cultural diversity.